You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of June 2017 on Monocle 24. Live from Studio One here in London, this is a special edition of Midori House. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up...
Your vote for us was a vote for change and a vote for our country and a vote for hope.
At the end, when everything is in, there is going to be a hung parliament.
I have just been to see Her Majesty the Queen, and I will now form a government. A government that can provide certainty and lead Britain forward at this critical time for our country.
What happens after an election which everybody lost? My guests Robert Fox and James Rogers will perform the daunting task of making sense of a general election result bizarre even by the standards of recent history. We'll look at what went wrong for Theresa May, what went right for Jeremy Corbyn, and what it means for Scotland and Northern Ireland. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Robert Fox, Defence Editor at the Evening Standard, and James Rogers, Head of International Journalism Studies at City University here in London. Welcome both. Tonight, we will be taking a long, hard look at Britain's most startling election result since the last one. 7 weeks ago, Prime Minister Theresa May called an early snap poll seeking to establish a substantial personal mandate before negotiating the UK's exit from the European Union, and to capitalise on polls suggesting that all she had to do to secure such a thumping result against weak opposition was turn up. Today, she finds herself scrabbling to corral a minority government in cahoots with an eccentric sect of Northern Irish paleo-conservatives who, well within living memory, used to chain up playground swings on Sundays. James, first of all, what in the wide world of sports just happened?
The British Prime Minister took what she thought was a fairly safe risk, and it turns out to be a massive gamble, which she lost. She thought, as you said in your introduction, that the polls meant she would get home very safely. And for most of this election campaign, the only question which people were asking was the size of the majority, which she would undoubtedly get. And it turned out that, in fact, rather than even securing what she had already, where she started with, she actually went backwards. She didn't fight a very good campaign. She probably regrets the decision not to take part in the television debates with the other leaders. And the Labour opposition leader, Jeremy Corbyn, fought a surprisingly good campaign. I think even his critics would agree that he performed beyond their expectations.
Robert, we said many times during the campaign, that the dog which did not bark, the issue which was surprisingly under-discussed, was really the only important one, which was Brexit. Is this, at some level, do you think, a revolt against last year's referendum?
I think it is to an extent that the referendum didn't answer a prime problem. Is it going to leave me better off than before? Am I going to feel happier in myself? That is the security question, because the Brexit debate, I don't want to rerun that again, but it's quite clear that referendum was run on two things, on sovereignty and migration. And these became sovereignty, who rules in Britain, famously another Conservative leader who went for a premature election needlessly. Edward Heath in 1974 did exactly the same thing during a miners' strike. It didn't matter. I do think things like welfare, the National Health Service, and the remoteness from Westminster really counted, because, as you pointed out with Jeremy Corbyn, Jeremy Corbyn only connect. He connected to young people in a way that the May camp, and it was a very tightly drawn camp, didn't really spot. That what was going on social media, on Twitter, was as important, possibly more important, be very interested to hear what James thinks, as what was going on in the discussion in the mainstream media.
Well, let's talk about that and about Corbyn in particular, James. And I will come right out and say now that I am among those people who thought that, I would have seen it roughly as Theresa May did. I assumed 7 weeks ago she was on course for a thumping majority. In fact, I assumed this time yesterday she was on course for a fairly handy majority. So I'm prepared to consume my helping of word pie like a champion there. But he was on the receiving end of a biffing from the right-wing press, indeed. Not all of that was unjustifiable. There is a long history of dodgy associations, eccentric viewpoints, etc., which we don't need to rehash. The question being, why did none of that mud stick? Or why did, from the point of view of the people flinging it, not enough of it stick?
Well, I think in this sense that the right-wing newspapers in this country used what they thought were tried and tested techniques. One of the most infamous examples is the 1992 general election, which is almost also famous in this country for the fact that pollsters got it magnificently wrong. The Sun lampooned the then Labour leader Neil Kinnock the day before polling day, and then later, a couple of days later, famously claimed credit for his subsequent defeat.
It was the Sun what won it.
The Sun what won it. What, spelled W-O-T, by the way, just to give it that sort of taste of vernacular. And the British press has got a wonderful tradition of being rude, occasionally cruel and funny, and there's nothing really wrong with that, but certainly the right-wing press do tend to really gun for Labour leaders they don't like at election time, and that has tended to work in the past, but something was definitely different this time. And I think there are big questions over whether that influence, perceived or real as it may be, has actually diminished, because they tried very similar tactics. The Sun newspaper yesterday morning, polling day, had a picture of Mr. Corbyn in a dustbin and said, "Don't put Britain in the Corbyn," making a rather poor pun on his name. But the fact is that the young people who may get all their news from social media, and as someone who teaches undergraduate students, you know, I sometimes despair of them reading print newspapers occasionally, it doesn't reach them in the same way that it does older generations, and it's not as effective as it once was. And so I think if it is true, and more deep analysis will reveal this, that there were a lot of first-time voters this time, a lot of young people who haven't tended to vote in the past, this wouldn't have had the same effect on them as it might otherwise have had.
Robert, was it perhaps the case as well that the right-wing press, the anti-Corbyn factions, assumed, as, again, I'm willing to admit I did, that when he became leader of the opposition that he wouldn't last. So they just unloaded everything they had instantly, and then by the time that he was actually standing in a general election, there was no ammunition left.
There was no ammunition left because they thought the proposition you have rightly pointed out, that this man is flaky, a pious flake, one middle-of-the-road commentator called him, Aronovich. But that they thought that it would be a self-fulfilling prophecy, and it didn't work. And what I think that they missed with Corbyn was two extraordinary things about him. He got better as he went along, and he looked so comfortable with himself. He may have been in his own world. He was almost zen-like.
I thought a key thing was that he clearly looked like he was really enjoying himself, and she clearly looked like she was having the worst six weeks of her life.
Well, exactly. I mean, down to crude things, the very staged performances, which contrasted on the youth programme, the one show of the BBC, that she very stiffly appears with her husband and talks about taking out the trash. And somebody said to Corbyn at the end, "Well, what do you think about when you go on your allotment, which is where he relaxes?" And he did absolutely grin all over his face. And at the end, he said, "Perhaps you'd like some of my jam from the allotment." It was just moments like that were extremely good. And he had some very wobbly moments because, as we were saying, that a close consort in many senses and friend of his, Diane Abbott, who had an absolute disaster and meltdown, had to be removed from the campaign only 48 hours from its conclusion. And yet that didn't seem to affect things at all. Mm. And even the right-wing mainstream press couldn't lay a glove on it. By the way, a lot of the serious moderate conservative press, like the Financial Times, got an awful lot of things wrong. Their depiction of what was actually going on in the north of England couldn't have been more wrong. They had several reports from the constituency of the North saying that the United Kingdom Independence Party vote was collapsing, true, and then said it was all going to the Conservatives, and Labour was bound to lose seats across the North. Mm. And these are people who've given their life to this kind of interpretation. Now, it is very, very interesting indeed, and I think it's something that James and you have pointed out, that there was a different world of the under 25-year-olds, the student population, the recent graduate population, and somehow Corbyn and John McDonnell, austere former Marxist or not so former Marxist, tapped into it, and in a way that none of the other side could.
James,
with the exception of Ruth Davidson, but we'll talk about her in a minute.
James, let's take a look at where this leaves Theresa May, who intends to carry on as Prime Minister. How even if she does manage to last in that job for the next few months, and you know, anything could happen, really, how stuffed is she?
I think she's pretty completely stuffed, actually. I can't possibly foresee how this parliament can last 5 years. It's just conceivable, I suppose, if the Conservatives somehow...
Well, it has to, doesn't it, if nobody challenges...
If there's a vote of no confidence. I mean, the margins are so thin now, you know. Mm. One of the theories about this was that she was going to get a big majority which would enable her... And so one school of thought suggested, not one to which I find it easy to subscribe, suggested that were she to get a big majority, she could ignore the extreme Brexiteers in her party.
Which was clearly the idea.
Now, of course, she is arguably in hock to them more than ever, and she's also in hock to the Democratic Unionist Party, to which she's apparently in the process of setting up an informal coalition. So it, I think it's very, very hot. And the one thing, the Conservative Party, the British Conservative Party, I think I'm right in saying, is one of the oldest political parties in the world. It is extremely efficient at reinventing itself.
Indeed.
Part of that ruthless efficiency is getting rid of leaders who are seen as no longer being capable of doing the job. She has put herself in that category now.
We will come to the DUP later in the show. Robert, I introduced this item by saying that this was an election which everybody lost, which I don't think is an unfair assessment. Is it possible to look at this and, when we're trying to figure out what the British public have just told us, is it possible that they've just told us we don't much care for Theresa May and we care for Jeremy Corbyn actually slightly less?
Something in that, but winners and losers, it's always very difficult to interpret. But what is interesting about this is the participation. I think the turnout was quite extraordinary and very healthy, having seen a fairly steady decline and appalling performances, as we all know, in local elections. Mm. The fact is, it may just be the Corbyn factor, but I don't think it's necessarily so, because what Ruth Davidson, whom I hope we can come on to, and Conservatives, which is just an extraordinary story on its own right, and by the way, for a very particular reason, makes it very, very difficult for a long-term cooperation to last a parliament between the DUP, the Democratic Unionist of Northern Ireland, and the Conservatives, actually, that young people got to believe in voter power again. And that is very, very important. But can I just add a comment to what you both said? It was this reiteration, and both big broadcast channels in the UK, BBC and ITV, were banging on about this. Oh, it's back to the good old two-party system. The other minority parties don't count. Oh, boy, do they count, because neither of the big parties can get a working majority. And I was saying to James just before coming in here, get back to my old second native Heath almost, where I've done a lot of journalism, it does remind me of a good old-fashioned Italian crisis, you know, when the winner, the horse trading goes on. No, I was saying, I did think it was with that brilliant drama documentary, the Magic Career of the Divine Giulio Andreotti, you need some wizard like Andreotti, which had always needed to come out of the bag and bang these coalitions together. Because following what James has said, what you have said, I think she meets her Philippi or her Waterloo, whatever classical battle analogy you want to do, at the party congress, at the party conference. I just do not see her getting through that, because following James's argument, just to hammer it home, I think the no confidence will come in when tough budget measures have to come in. Then you will see people falling apart. And I think that's going to really sink her more than the Brexit negotiations.
James, on that point that Robert raised, the return to two-party politics, and it has been a sort of a fairly, in terms of voter share, an extraordinary re-embrace of something that people said was a thing of the past, notwithstanding the importance Robert points out of the minority parties now. But is that, has that happened because, whatever else you could say about this election, the one thing that nobody could say was to retreat into that old sore of like, oh, well, there's no real difference between Labour and the Tories. Mm. This time there was a difference. There was a choice. And have we learnt that when given that option, then people will embrace the two-party model?
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, Robert mentioned the Financial Times, and one might also mention the Economist here, because those newspapers, those sort of, you know, broadly pro-market, pro-capitalist newspapers, who for the last 30 years have broadly looked on approvingly, first at the governments of Margaret Thatcher and then of Tony Blair, have said, well, this is over. Economic liberalism is to a large extent over, and it's not really on offer here. The Conservatives who've championed it, Labour who subsequently did, have both made significant retreats from it. And so there was a very stark choice here, I think. And I think that energy energise people, but it is difficult to know what people were voting for, and I'm quite sure the researchers will look at that ahead of probably the next general election, which we're going to have before 5 years are out. Because if I think of
possibly
my part,
before 5 weeks.
Well, even so, I mean, I think of my part of West London. Brentford and Isleworth take one constituency, a very, very small Labour majority, went from 450 went to 12,000 last night, and the Conservative, who lost her seat 2 years ago, was trying to get it back last night, was roundly defeated. And looking at some of the accounts, she said, you know, there are a lot of Conservative Remainers in London who felt very badly let down by the Conservative Party and Mrs May's apparent, you know, extreme approach to Brexit, and may have voted Labour for the first time in their life. The opposite happening in some parts of the north of England, where it's interesting to note Mrs May ran, in effect, a presidential campaign because she was talking to people who for generations had never, ever considered voting Conservative. So Conservative appeared in very little letters on the leaflet, and her name appeared in very big ones.
Just a final thought from each of you before we take a closer look at Scotland and Northern Ireland. It is an appalling question to ask guests in these times, and I'm apologising in advance, but I want a quick answer from you on each of this. Robert, what happens next?
Well, I think the thing that you've pointed to is a phenomenon which is coming up into public coin in political and journalistic discussion, Overton's shift or Overton's window, which is where the centre of a debate shifts. The Labour Party has gone more radical. The Conservatives have gone more radical to the right. And you get things like the FT and The Economist, and even to The Guardian and Times to some extent, saying whatever happened to the middle ground. Well, you're not going to reinvent the middle ground in a hurry. That's the first thing, to give quite a short answer. They are going to rumble on. There will be another general election. I draw a bow at a venture. It will either be late this year or it will be in the spring. But I don't think they can put it off much later.
And James?
I would broadly agree with that. I just can't see how this Parliament certainly can last 5 years. I can't actually see really how it can last 1 year. I mean, I think the numbers just don't add up, and I don't think that this coalition in everything but name is going to prove to be enduring or stable at all.
OK, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Robert Fox and James Rogers. Coming up next, what did we learn about Scotland, and what are we about to learn about Northern Ireland?
Who can say where the world's headed? Well, with Monocle's transport-themed June issue in tow, you'll reach your destination enlivened and entertained, and with a good read on where things are heading. We stop off in Van, a Turkish city with a Persian pull that's luring fun-loving Iranians across the border. We meet Munich's fast-moving mobility players, get in gear with the finest bike retailers, and work up a sweat at Techno Gym's Toothsome HQ in Emilia Romagna in Italy. We're also on set in New York, in Hamburg for the annual Aircraft Interiors Expo, and in Albania for the Prime Minister's fictional final feast. All that, plus Oslo's fashion startups, the small-scale supermarkets with big ideas, and a peek at London's most ambitious new hospitality venture. So strap in. Monocle's high-octane transport issue is on newsstands now. Or head to monocle.com to become a subscriber.
You are back with Midori House, with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Robert Fox and James Rogers. Now, in this general election across the UK as a whole, as we've been learning, both the Conservatives and Labour lost. In Scotland, the Scottish National Party both won and lost. The SNP remained Scotland's largest party, but only after sustaining something of a kicking. The 56 seats they won in 2015 reduced to 21. SNP leader and Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon said she would reflect carefully on this result. Robert, first of all, did she try to make this election basically a referendum on another referendum?
It ended up being that. And the Scots, canny Scots, didn't want it because the economy is in such a state and it's getting worse, and it could lead them to a great deal of travail. Also, that Nicola Sturgeon, I think, recognised she had got a formidable opponent in Ruth Davidson. Let's get that out of the way. Who was one of the stars of
the Conservative leader who brought the Tory seat count in Scotland from 1 up to 13. May, in fact, have saved Theresa May's bacon.
Exactly. And I think that May knows that, and certainly Ruth Davidson Johnson knows that, and she's a very particular person. And I think it's going to make an alliance with the DUP very, very difficult. But a very good friend of mine, a well-known Scottish correspondent, Jim Naughtie, was saying that privately he always suspected that Nicola Sturgeon was quite happy for Ruth to do well, to take the referendum off the agenda. Having gone for it, being pushed into saying we'll have another referendum, the Scottish First Minister seems to have been ruining it, regretting it ever since she opened her mouth on that, because it would lead to a separate Scotland. Trying to re-enter Europe in different terms would be appallingly difficult.
With a hard border with England,
yes,
in this particular instance. James, is this the end of the line for Scottish independence?
I don't think it's the end of the line, but I think it's going to definitely be a pause. I mean, after the way that it built up to the 2014 referendum, where it was, you know, faintly, you know, convincingly rejected. Then, of course, it was brought back very much onto the agenda last year after the Brexit referendum, because one of the reasons that the former Conservative administration had said to Scotland, look, if you want to stay in the EU, you need to stay in the UK. And, of course, now that's no longer the case. But I think I just want to pick up on something that you said, Andrew. I think it's astonishing if one looks at Scottish Westminster election results over the last 30 or 40 years to reflect upon the fact that, yes, the Conservatives were saved by the vote standing up in Scotland, which is amazing, because for much of the last century, Scotland was moving towards being a one-party Labour state, and then latterly, the last election, that astonishing success for the Scottish National Party, and now it's the fact that those 13 Conservative seats have shored up and made sure that the Conservatives, even if they don't have an overall majority, are still the largest single party at Westminster.
It is extraordinary, and it does rather, I guess, mean that certain sectors of Scotland are going to have to abandon their dearly cherished hobby of complaining about having Conservative governments inflicted on them by perfidious Albion. Robert, you mentioned Ruth Davidson, who has proved herself a singular leader and a singular campaigner. With everything as up for grabs as it now appears to be, is she potentially a Prime Minister? She doesn't have a seat at Westminster, but that is presumably reasonably easily fixable.
Up to now, she's a farmer, she's got a very stable relationship, she's always ruled it out. As of this morning, she has said, I could come south, as they put it there. I think there are people who are fed up with the flat earthers of Brexit and the dinosaurs, and fed up with the way Mrs. May has mismanaged her campaign and the conduct of the prime ministership, enclosed in herself, surrounded by only two or three maximum trusted advisers. They would welcome, really, to use the awful phrase, people person, like Ruth Davidson. Can we just briefly mention, because it's got to come up now, why she's in difficulty with the DUP. During one of the campaigns, being the kind of gutsy person she is, she married her same gender partner, and didn't make a big display about it, very relaxed.
He was also a Catholic, I believe.
Yeah, and a Catholic. And the DUP is ultra-Protestant in its origins and has campaigned against same-sex marriage. And this, I think, it's not trivial. I think it's a very serious point as to why this marriage, political marriage, pardon the pun, with the DUP is not going to last.
Well, that does tee us up nicely for the final item up for discussion tonight, which is the news that Theresa May intends to continue governing, rather, in cahoots with the Democratic Unionist Party of Northern Ireland, who won 10 MPs and will have prompted much frantic Googling on the British mainland, where Northern Irish politics is regarded, when regarded at all, as a baffling clamour of sectarian obscurantism of mercifully limited interest to the outside world. Those who managed to read the DUP's website before it crashed under the weight of sudden traffic, true story, might have required reminding that they were in fact reading what they were reading in 2017. James, they have some extremely, let's put it charitably, old school ideas about climate change, creationism, homosexuality, etc., 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 and by old school I mean cranky and batty. How undignified is this for Theresa May?
Well, it's certainly not the way that she foresaw things when she called the election. She wasn't thinking, if I don't get home, I'll be able to rely on the DUP. I think it's an absolute move of last resort, which is one of the reasons why, as I say, I can't see this Parliament lasting. I mean, just to put that into some context, Robert has already mentioned this, but one of the DUP members of the Parliament with whom whom the Conservatives are now going to be working, expressed both his adherence to creationism and his opposition to same-sex marriage with what he probably considered a rather clever bon mot, that when it was in the Garden of Eden, it was Adam and Eve and not Adam and Steve.
Brilliant.
And so I think, you know, they are serious social conservatives, as the Reuters news agency has rather diplomatically
put
it.
Again, one way of putting it.
Exactly,
I believe I can remember them campaigning in Belfast against pink buses, which I think they believed might have a corrupting...
I think it was part of the Save Ulster from Sodomy campaign.
Yes, that was the one. Yeah. They thought that buses being painted pink might have an undesirable impact.
Talking about creation, it was the creation of the Reverend Dr. Ian Paisley, who was a very effective politician, whatever.
Again, one way of putting it.
And his son, Ian Paisley Jr., is a very important figure in it. Slightly more moderate than his father, I would say, but there are others who are cut exactly from the same cloth as the Reverend Dr. Paisley. He was quite an effective Prime Minister, but had all these views, as you rightly proclaimed. It's not a natural fit. It is quite bizarre, and I think a lot of the more progressive or centrist part of the Conservative Party, like the new father of the House, Ken Clark, will find this absolutely baffling.
I did meet Reverend Ian Paisley Sr. on one occasion. There was a process of negotiation to get him to talk to me, even off the record, because I was working at the time for a Sunday newspaper. Mm. And of course, he believed that Sunday newspapers defiled the Sabbath. James, is this also a bit ripe of the Tories to get into an alliance with the DUP, having beaten up on Jeremy Corbyn extensively, and I, for one, would argue quite rightly for his long history of association with unsavoury dingbats from Northern Ireland?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a lot of people point out the Democratic Unionist Party, or parts of it, have had links with paramilitaries on the other side, on the pro-British side, for want of a better phrase. But it is, I mean, I think this is something that was never foreseen, has been absolutely forced upon the Prime Minister as a last resort. I don't see how it can last, and I think it does sit very uncomfortably. I mean, let's not forget, there are plenty of people who have returned to Parliament as on a Conservative mandate who will have been the same ones who've voted for the gay marriage legislation, which was passed when David Cameron was Prime Minister only a few years ago.
By the way, they've got a blocking vote in, though, DUP, against a hard Brexit in one particular regard, and it's over the border with Ireland and with Northern Ireland. Yeah. They do not want a hard Brexit leading to a hard border and stopping the free movement of people north and south, which would come in. It won't come up, but it's something we can point to immediately.
It's a position itself which is hugely contradictory. Surely they can see that it's not in their economic interest, but they campaign for, you know, what we would call a hard Brexit.
Yeah. And James, what do we think the DUP might want, you know, other than an end to Sunday trading and mixed dancing?
Well, it's a little hard to know at this stage, but they're going to be in a position to ask for it, let's put it that way. I mean, the last time that the Conservative Party found themselves in anything approaching this situation was the last Conservative government before Tony Blair won the Labour landslide in 1997, when the then Prime Minister John Major frequently required the support of Ulster Unionists to get legislation through.
And that was government. Yeah.
They were in a very strong position. So, I mean, I can't imagine what these issues might be, but individual issues which only pertain to Northern Ireland, they're going to say, unless you look after this for us, we're not going to support this legislation. That's why it's going to be very difficult to make this work.
If this goes into weeks, let alone months, the DUP will demand devolution of powers, full powers again, and that will lead to yet another train crash, because they can only make a government work, they, the DUP, with Sinn Féin, which managed to wipe out the moderate SDLP, Social Democrat and Labour Party, just wiped them out completely. Yeah.
Sinn Féin could,
election.
Of course, make everything really hilarious by deciding to take their seats.
Yeah, but they're very straight. I mean, the Shinners on this, because they all campaigned, whatever you say, and they said part of the deal is we're abstentionists, and the voters understood that, so it would be a big, big change.
I was in an election party at the London School of Economics last night, and I found myself explaining that to a number of foreign correspondents from other. But surely, might they in these... And I said, no way.
Yeah. It's part of the DNA. It's part of the history. It really is.
On that note, we will have to leave it there. There is much more to be said, of course, and we will have programmes saying much more of it over the coming days, weeks, months, however long this latest instalment of the circus lasts. Thank you very much to our guests on our special election programme, James Rogers and Robert Fox. Today's edition of Midori House was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Hunter Day Achikalan. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. There's music next at 1900, It's the Menu, followed by The Cinema Show, and I'll be back with more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time on Monday, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks very much for listening. Have a great weekend.